Oregon Health Plan. And we'll begin with Bruce Goldberg and Joy Soros. And Ruby, you want to come up as well? Welcome.
Thank you.
Whoever's going to start first, if you want to put your name on the record, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon is a not-for-profit 501c3 health plan providing care to about 90,000 Oregon health plan recipients in 16 Oregon counties, both urban and rural. Today I have with me Joy Soros, who is an access developer for CARE Oregon. Her responsibilities include working with our providers to increase access to care for Oregon Health Plan members. I think as you're all aware, access to health care is critically important in our state. Having a card that says OHS Oregon Health Plan on it does not necessarily mean that you have entry into a doctor's office. Without a primary care provider, you have access to an emergency room, which is a very expensive mode of care. So Joy spends a great deal of her time developing access, making sure that providers understand the Oregon Health Plan population, and she will be providing you with information today that will be helpful in the decisions that you'll need to make down the line, I hope. In addition, I have with me Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who will be sharing with you some information on the Oregon Health Plan that I hope will be quite useful relative to how our plan, CARE Oregon, works. And literally, Rick Berkovian has asked that Bruce give a brief overview for the committee so that you have an understanding of the Oregon Health Plan, its inception, providers, clients, as well as the contractors. So Bruce will be sharing with you for just a little bit.
Thank you, Ruby. Senator Shields?
Just a kind of parameter around which, for us to understand things, you said that you have 90,000 clients. How many of them would still be your clients? I mean, how many of them are the new eligibles, and how many are the Medicaid ones?
I happen to have that right in front of me.
Good.
Of that 90,000, about 14,000, a little over 14,000, are this OHP standard population.
So those would be the new eligibles?
Yes.
Okay.
Dr. Goldberg.
Mr. Senator?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank
Good
you.
Afternoon.
Pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Dr. Bruce Goldberg. I am the medical director with CARE Oregon. I also have a couple of other responsibilities in my professional life. I also work as an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine at OHSU, and I still see patients for a small percentage of what I do. As medical director for CARE Oregon, as Ruby indicated, we care for 90,000 people on the Oregon Health Plan. I've been involved with CARE Oregon since its inception 8 years ago, and I think have a background in which to talk about and to provide you some background into the Oregon Health Plan, how it works from the perspective of health plans, doctors, clients, et cetera. My plan was to provide you with some brief background into the Oregon Health Plan, a little bit of history, and really give you the opportunity to answer some questions. I came to Oregon in 1990 having worked for 10 years running a public health service hospital in Zuni, New Mexico. I spent my career in the organization, delivery, and provision of health care to vulnerable and low-income populations. When I came to Oregon in 1990, what I found was a state where 20% of the population were uninsured and didn't have access to health care. We had a Medicaid program which cared predominantly for women and children, did not care for working poor individuals. The reimbursement that Medicaid paid at that time was substandard to the point that there was an access problem. There were very few providers that were open to Medicaid patients. The dollars to reimburse for care was substandard. There was a lack of access. We had many of our citizens getting care in emergency rooms. We had hospitals providing large amounts of charity care. As you can imagine, 20% of our population had no insurance. This 20% of our population gets sick just like everybody else. In fact, what we do know about low-income individuals is that they get sick more than wealthier individuals. We had large numbers of individuals getting care in emergency rooms, hospitals providing large amounts of uncompensated care, physicians providing large amounts of uncompensated care, a situation that was frustrating for everybody. It was frustrating for individuals that couldn't get health care, that had chronic health care needs. It was frustrating for physicians who either were seeing large numbers of uninsured patients in emergency rooms or were seeing Medicaid patients at very low reimbursement rates and unable to meet the overhead. It was frustrating for hospitals. It was frustrating for all of Oregon because, indeed, when somebody showed up at the emergency room, whether you were insured, uninsured, or whatever, you would wait longer because many of our citizens were getting cared for in the emergency room. We were all paying the cost for that care that insurance wasn't covering. It was a frustrating time, and I don't think anybody liked that. And I actually don't think anyone wants to go back to what I've heard called basic Medicaid. I mean, that was a time when what basic Medicaid really is women and children, not working poor, and the basic Medicaid benefit package is a package that includes doctor services, hospital care, and diagnostic testing, lab tests and x-rays. Basic Medicaid doesn't include drugs, doesn't include pharmaceuticals, which are clearly necessary to keep people healthy. It's one thing to go to a doctor and have your high blood pressure or your diabetes diagnosed. It doesn't mean a whole lot if you can't afford the medications to control those. It doesn't include mental health care, doesn't include chemical dependency and substance abuse, doesn't include dental care and a lot of the services that are needed to keep people healthy, keep them working, keep them out of our emergency rooms, and help them have the kind of lives that I think we would all like them to have. You all know better than I do about what happened in 1994 in the Oregon Health Plan, which was really an attempt to do several things. One, it was an attempt to reimburse those people who provided care to the Medicaid population at a rate that was more reasonable, that was more commensurate with what the true cost of care was to end cost shifting. And it was an attempt to take and lower the uninsured. We saw uninsurance decrease in Oregon from 20% to now somewhere around 11 or 12%. Who got added to Medicaid were indeed working poor. These were low-income adults, families, who were making below 100% of poverty, but many of whom are working. And these are the patients I take care of. Take care of a lot of individuals who are employed at low-wage jobs, who have families, and they either, on one hand, qualify for the Oregon Health Plan by being just below 100% of poverty. Many of them don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan because their wages put them just above poverty, and they have no coverage and limited access. In that environment, what we saw was providers coming back to caring for this population in large numbers. We saw large numbers of organizations coming up to meet the challenge of how do we administer this kind of care to this sort of population. That's where Care Oregon came from. We started at the inception of the Oregon Health Plan as a partnership between Oregon Health Sciences University, the Multnomah County Health Department and the community and migrant health centers around the state. In essence, the historical safety net who were caring for the Medicaid population. We started, and when we opened our doors in 1994, we had 9,000 members. We now have 90,000 members, and we've actually now are a very different organization. We're no longer just a safety net organization. We have providers from all over the state, from all types of practices, community-based practices, private practices, health departments, health centers, safety net, non-safety net, large groups, small groups, hospitals, practices that really represent the fabric of the doctors in the state. What do we try and do as a health plan? We try and do a couple of things. We provide access to care for people. We try, and I think we do a good job of administering the health care dollar, of using the health care dollar in a cost-effective way so that we get the biggest bang for our buck, so to speak. Healthcare costs are increasing everywhere. We all know that. What we do as a health plan is help manage that, help get people to care, help provide them access, try and figure out how to take that healthcare dollar and divide it in such a way so that hospitals are reimbursed as adequately as the dollar allows for the care that they provide, so doctors are reimbursed as adequately as the dollar allows for to provide the care, so that clients get access to medical care, pharmaceuticals, diagnostic testing, so that we can keep people out of emergency rooms, so that we can treat illnesses that, if left untreated, would cause tremendous personal damage to individuals, harm to our society in terms of the burden of caring for individuals who are disabled. I saw a gentleman the other day who is on the Oregon Health Plan who has hypertension and diabetes. I've been caring for him for 10 years. He's been on and off the Oregon Health Plan based on his work, much of which is seasonal. When he's on the Oregon Health Plan, he's able to afford the medicines, the testing, and the care that he requires. When he's off the Oregon Health Plan, in many ways, he can't. And when he's off the Oregon Health Plan are the times actually that he's working. I just saw him the other day. He came in to say that he couldn't come in for several months. Why? Because actually he had gotten a job, and now he doesn't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. His employer doesn't provide health insurance. He can't afford the $150 worth of medicine that he takes a month, and he's trying to figure out how to manage that. He's going to try and pay for as much medicine as he can. What he came in to do was to ask me, Doc, which medicines can I get along with and which medicines can't I? And what I had to figure out was, well, what do I tell a gentleman like that? Don't control your high blood pressure and face the realities of perhaps ending up in the hospital with a stroke or heart attack, or don't take your diabetes medicines and face the potential of ending up with hypoglycemic coma in the emergency room, or the problems, the various other medical problems of uncontrolled diabetes. I don't think any of us want to see a return to basic Medicaid. Certainly, I know the doctors I work with don't want to. The hospitals that I've spoken with don't want to. This was a chaotic time, and a time in which we had less people, we had more uninsured, and we had people, and we had providers who were getting paid very little for what they provided. I think the challenge for all of us for the future is to figure out how we can continue to provide the kind of care that makes sense for our citizens in the ways that we can afford to. I stop there and see if there's any questions.
Go ahead. I have a couple questions, and my name is Craig Prinz, and Senator Minnis asked me to kind of join this committee, and I don't know a lot about the Oregon Health Plan. I hope that was the idea, to have some fresh eyes. So I'll ask some possibly stupid questions, and it may or may not educate the committee, and if you know all these answers, just raise your hand and let me know if this all is something you've covered before. But one of the things that we read and have talked about are these audits that have come through and in setting the capitation rates and things. How does that work for your, you know, as a not-for-profit? How do you deal with that process, say, differently from region or province? I don't understand exactly how that works.
For the Oregon Health Plan, it's actually all the same.
Okay.
There's one rate. Rates are set, and health plans contract with OMAP. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're...
I know there's one rate, okay, but I assume, say, a profit organization would do some kind of calculation and have in the contract what kind of people they'd want to cover, correct?
When you contract with the state, you contract... No, it's a great question, because I think that gets that. Is it possible to do what's called in the insurance industry is cherry pick? Can you either try and take those people who you get paid the most for, or try and take those people who use the least amount of services? And the way things are set up, it's set up to not allow plans to do that. When we contract with the state, you contract by geographic locale. So you contract to provide services to people in certain counties, which means you open up to all of the Medicaid clients in those counties, and those clients are actually in 16 different rate categories. With a health plan, we get $600 for caring for some people, and we get $80 or $100 for caring for others. We know that children generally, and fortunately, and thank goodness, children are generally healthy, and therefore the cost of caring for children are much less than the cost of caring for 60-year-old disabled individuals.
So to follow up, in this audit, it makes a point of the fact that there's fewer and fewer managed care providers out there able to make it on these rates, I guess is the reason why.
Right.
How are you able to avoid that?
We've been able to do that because this is the business we've always been in, as I think I mentioned to you. And I think most of the people that are now, most of the contractors that are in the Oregon Health Plan now, this is their business. They are, most of the contractors now in the Oregon Health Plan are plans that are partnerships between physicians, hospitals, healthcare providers in their communities who have all gotten together and tried to figure out how do you do the best based on the race. And I think that that's a different conversation, and these are different health plans than commercial health plans who are businesses like we are, but I think who make that decision based on, I don't know how they make that decision.
I assume they make it on a risk assessment of some kind if you're going to get this rate, and I mean, I'm sure, like you said, everyone would like to cherry pick the healthy, you know, I'm just trying to understand how that...
I think part of it is also, I don't know what, I can't speak to the motivation of commercial health insurers. What I do know is a few things. I think, number one, there are a lot of unique needs to serving Medicaid clients. And I think that when health plans are set up around dealing with different sorts of individuals,
right,
that their whole business is geared around the kind of service that they provide. And there's all sorts of different levels of service. There are restaurants in our community who provide services to wealthier people and restaurants whose menus are such that they provide good, wholesome food to a different clientele. I think it's some of the same thing with health plans, that that the health plans that are around are community-based, wholesome health plans who are looking to figure out how do you provide a wholesome and adequate diet of health care. And that I think commercial plans have contracts with businesses as opposed to the state. They're very different lines of business. And I think what we've seen is the market has fallen out. It's not just CareOregon, but it's all the other plans.
Okay.
could you hold, excuse me a second, Craig? Senator Shields?
Yeah, well, did these quit working?
Okay, it had.
I think we're dead here.
Speak for yourself.
I need a new health plan. What can I do?
Come join ours.
What I meant is we're used to having... Let me tell you, what the legislature needs right now is feedback. Dr. Goldberg, since counsel was going around the edges of it, I would like you to sketch for me. I don't want all the detail. Couldn't handle it. But could you sketch for me a little bit, a thumbnail sketch of what your capitation categories look like? I mean, how many children are among this 90,000? What are the varying degrees of, or did you already do a handout and I didn't see it?
We've got a handout which we'll give you. We have 14,000 of our 90,000 members are adults and couples. That's the expansion population that you're talking about. 10,000 of our members are blind and disabled. 28,000 of our members are in categories that are children categories, but these categories don't always, there are children in some of the other categories as well. 48% of our members are children under the age of 17. We have 4,000 who are in old age categories. There's 30,000 who are the TANF population, Temporary Aid to Needy Families. And we can provide you with all the statistics from a percentage basis, 18% adults and couples, 12% blind and disabled, 32% children, 4% old age, and 34% TANF. Is that...
And follow up, Madam
Chair. Go ahead,
Senator. Just following up on that, each of those categories then has its own
rate. Actually, those are lumped together. There's actually 16 rate categories. We did a little bit of lumping there. Because in children, there are about four or five different rate categories based on children's ages. So there are 16 different rate categories, and we get capitated a certain dollar amount for each of those individuals in those rate categories, and it ranges from I'm the doctor, not the CFO, but it ranges from in the range of about 80 to 600, and someone I'm sure will correct me later, but that's probably as gives you a sense of the expanse.
Well, if I might react to what you just said, I was on a plane from Chicago back here a couple of years ago, and I ended up sitting beside a guy. He said, I set up health plans. That's what when we started talking, and I said, oh, good, you must be a doctor. And he said, no, I'm an accountant. Yeah. You know, so I understand.
Well, actually, the reason I still see patients and are involved in what I do is because I think we've got to look at how we provide healthcare service. We've got to have the people providing healthcare services who understand the issues from the perspective of the clients, from the perspective of the docs, from the perspective of the state. And that's why I wear the kind of hats that I do, and also because I have no hair.
Okay, we're going to have to move along. Joy, did you want to go ahead with your testimony? And if you have a great deal more, if you'd like to stay, I have some people who need to testify that need to get to Gold Beach, and since I was born in that area, I know how far it is, so I want to be respectful of their need as well. So if you want to present more after you're through, I'd just ask that you stay, and we'll do that again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joy Ford. I work for CARE Oregon. I'm an access developer, and I'll give you a real brief overview of our members and providers that are with CARE Oregon. With regards to our members, again, we have approximately 90,000 members that are assigned to CARE Oregon. 82% are less than 45 years old. More than 50% are less than 20 years old, and 62% of our members live in the Portland metropolitan area. Also, 30% of our members are people of color. With regards to our providers, again, we're in 16 communities. We have over 2,000 practitioners that are contracted with Care Oregon to provide services to our members. They range, as Bruce mentioned, from small solo practices in rural communities to large hospitals to specialists, every single specialty there is across the state. Although we have a large number of providers in our on our panel, one predicament that we have is that we're having a hard time getting some providers contracting with our plan to provide services. And the number one reason why they say that that's the case is because the reimbursement is not high enough. And they feel that the reimbursement isn't high, as well as the complexity of our members make it so it's a lot more feasible for them to provide care to high-paid commercial patients as opposed to Oregon Health Plan patients. And again, that goes back to
the talk. Let's try to have you move your microphone just a little bit closer. Patsy, are you getting that okay? Is anyone else having trouble hearing her besides me? Just a little bit. Let's try the microphone closer.
Sure. Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
All right. I should repeat maybe the last couple of sentences you gave because it was really high. I hated to interrupt you, but it's hard to hear.
No problem. Thank you, Madam Chair. Although we have 2,000 practitioners that are contracted with Care Oregon, we still have a problem with not being able to have enough providers contract us with us so we can provide access to every single specialty in every single area. And part of the reason for that, actually the number one reason why providers cite that, is because reimbursement is not high enough. In addition, the complexity of our members, their medical conditions as well as their social conditions make it so it's more difficult to care for Oregon Health Plan members. So combining the low rates in addition to the complexity of seeing our members make it so providers will more likely want to contract with higher paying commercial plans as opposed to Oregon Health Plan contracted plans. And because of that, there's a few access problems.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here to testify this afternoon. I have a question about what would be the impact on people around Oregon if the legislature fails to allocate or distribute the safety net clinic funding?
This actually flows from the point Joy just made. Reimbursement is such that access is becoming a problem. On Care Oregon, to give you an idea, 16% of our provider panel are safety net providers, but that provider panel cares for over half of our members. The safety net is clearly, as access becomes more and more difficult, it's the safety net which has stepped forward to provide some of that. That's the role of the safety net. If that money went away, there would be even greater difficulty in getting access to care. I don't know what we would do as a health plan without a healthy safety net.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordon.
We heard some testimony on yesterday from, I believe it was the Department of Human Services, the reduction option related to the Oregon Health Plan. And one of the things pointed out to us was that, in addition to what you said, Dr. Goldberg, about access, that there would also be, or may be, a financial hardship on some clinics with inadequate operating margins. And we've asked that the department come back to us with a list of clinics that fit that category of currently having inadequate operating margins. But is there some information that you have that could enlighten us as to what that impact might look like?
I guess what I could just briefly talk to you about is the sorts of how practices manage what's called their payer mix and balance that. And I think that's what this is about, that physicians who are in practice, hospitals, or businesses, and what they try and do is figure out how to balance their lines of business. And obviously, if there are lines of business that support your operating costs and you're going to provide more access to that than lines of business that don't. In the safety net, so what a lot of practices are doing is balancing commercial insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and figuring out the mix that works for them. In the safety net, the safety net balances Medicaid dollars against no dollars, because it what the safety net cares for are Medicaid clients and the uninsured. And so that's, if you can imagine the difficulties that practices are having in managing, balancing Medicaid against commercial insurance, it's the situation is much more difficult for safety net clinics. And if that funding goes away, that funding is what allows safety net clinics to see the higher proportions of Medicaid and the large numbers of uninsured that they see.
Thank you. Senator George, then Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For any three of you, this question could be answered, and that would be, Joey, you mentioned the complexity in addition to the capitation rate, and I'm, what I'm wondering is, you know, you can make me work cheap, but if you're knowing me while you're doing it with a bunch of complexity, then I'm less likely to participate in your program. Can you guys tell me, are there things we can do? Because I see a real collision of even concepts. We're looking at audits to say we don't have adequate data. Everything to you guys that the system may be too complex and too cumbersome. Is that what I was hearing? Because I've heard that from others.
I think Joy was talking about the complexity of our members,
mm-hmm.
Which is that they're these are individuals who have high proportion of mental illness, substance abuse, large numbers of the individuals who have a lot of social needs who make caring for them much more difficult.
Rather than reporting compliance. Okay,
yeah.
By the way, Madam Chair, if I could add this, Senator Shields mentioned this. If anyone would like to call a legislator, they can call 1-800-332-2313, and they'll be placed through to the mail for each legislator that you request.
Thank you, Senator George. Senator Shields, what did you mention that for? Senator Farioli.
I need to ask for feedback. That's yes. What I'm, yes.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I guess I need to ask some questions about capitation. I'd like any of the contractors to talk about the methodology, whether it's comprehensible. I mean, there's 16 different categories of capitation. And you often must argue about which category people fit in. How much time do you spend with that process? Is it a muddle?
It's complicated. I think that it's technically complicated. Like a lot of things, it's technically complicated. It would certainly be, I don't think the issue is the 16 rate categories. It could be 100 rate categories. The issue is the adequacy of the rate categories. If you went to one rate category, it could be a lot simpler, but if that rate wasn't enough to provide the services for the population, it wouldn't matter. And actuarial calculations of this sort are complex and difficult. But I don't think it's a matter of the numbers of rate categories. It's whether or not the prediction, what actuaries try and do is predict for us the future. And if that prediction is right on, then it's a great methodology. And if that prediction is off, then it's not a very good methodology.
And, Chairman, that reminds me of the three statisticians that went deer hunting in eastern Oregon and the first shot a foot low and missed the deer, and the second shot a foot high over the deer, and the third jumped up and yelled, "We got him." We have a capitation problem, and I think people are tap dancing around it. Are the capitation rates adequate for the level of care that you're providing? And if they're not, doesn't that result in cost shifting?
They're not adequate. There's no doubt about it. I don't think that they're not adequate because of the methodology. I think they're not adequate because what of the dollars that are put into there. What the actuaries do is tell us how to split those dollars out. But if you put more dollars in, those capitation rates will become more adequate. No, they're not adequate. We're paying physicians somewhere between 50.5 and 3/4 of what they're getting paid for by commercial insurance. We're paying them less than what Medicare pays them. I talk to doctors every day, and I go to their offices, and I look at the dollars, and the dollars we're paying them don't cover all of their costs. What physicians basically tell me, and I've seen talked to enough of them and looked at their finances, that what the capitation rate basically does is just barely covers overhead. It doesn't pay their salary. And what physicians feel they're doing is giving their care away. So the rates are not adequate.
All right. And Madam Chairman, the capitation rates are inadequate. So we know that we're in a situation of diminishing returns, and that physicians, practitioners, clinics, and hospitals every day have to get up and look at whether or not they're going to be able to continue to offer services. And every day, practitioners are making the decision that they will not continue to offer services, and that means access drops off. But every day, and this is the thing that people don't really want to confront, every day that a CFO in a hospital makes the decision to continue, they are making the decision to build a private, uninsured citizen more. 125% of costs in some cases. Sometimes much more. Is that accurate?
I don't know what hospitals are doing, but I can tell you that there's good data to show that the uninsured are the people who tend to get billed the cost of care and try and pay the cost of care. Insurance companies, whether it be Medicaid or whoever, doesn't pay LIPA. We pay HOPEL, and some of us pay far below HOPEL.
All right, so Madam Chairman, the dirty little secret in this process is the cost shifting to anyone that doesn't have an advocacy group behind them. And the advocacy group could be the insurance company, it could be the HMO, it could be the actuarial that essentially shields the patient from the cost of care. But those costs don't disappear. They simply get downstream to somebody who will pay them. And sometimes they pay them without knowing that they're paying them. And sometimes those are people that also can least afford it, somebody that doesn't even have an insurance policy. So I guess the other question is, we're about to see an exponential increase in the scope of the Oregon Health Plan. What's that going to do to the already stretched and stressed and overextended Oregon Health Plan, in your opinion?
When you say an expansion in terms of more members, if we add more members and we look at in a way that's revenue neutral, if that's possible, that would be a good thing. We would have more people getting health care. If we can't afford it, then it doesn't make a lot of sense. But someone pays the cost of that care regardless. I think you're absolutely right. And it's not just the uninsured. It's what businesses pay for health insurance. Those costs get shared across our community.
And, Madam Chairman, I guess what I'm concerned about is that this cost-shifting issue is not well understood. It's not transparent to people that that's what happens. The capitation rates are not fair in that they don't really absorb the cost of services, that we're relying on the altruism of sector, which, you know, doctors eat this, hospitals eat this, clinicians eat this extra cost that they don't pass on. And if they don't eat it, then the citizen that walks in the door, either with an insurance plan or uninsured, eats it, or the community at large eats it. And those are all undisclosed costs. And I guess I'm just to the point where I think we ought to put the cards on the table and let people see what the cost of health care in Oregon really is and what the downstreaming of the hidden costs are. Because if we have that discussion, I think we have to force ourselves to confront a couple of things. That we need a simpler, more transparent, more comprehensible capitation system. That we need to make decisions about what kind of care and where and when we can afford to provide it. And that we need to own up to the fact that there are certain kinds of care and certain levels of care. And I'm talking about in terms of 185% of the federal poverty rate. That Oregonians may not be willing or able to afford at this time. And to fail to acknowledge the reality of that is essentially to bury those costs and downstream those costs to people that are, in fact, being victimized by our system financially. Now, I'm trying to balance that with the issue that there's an endless, absolutely endless need for health care, quality health care, access to health care, everything from prenatal through geriatric. I mean, it is a huge problem of access. It's a huge problem of distribution. It's a huge problem of cost, and particularly in the rural and inner city areas of our state. You know, those demographics are identical. And that worries me. We're not having an honest discussion. The need is endless. We have finite resources, and we're engaged in cost shifting in a way that's not disclosed to Oregonians. And that's what's wrong with the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you, Mayor.
Excellent points, Senator Ferrioli, but we do have a time management problem. And what we'll do is go on to the next panel. This has been a panel of nonprofit, and we'll go on to the other panels. If you have time to stick around, there are some members that wanted to ask you some more questions. I'd appreciate it. And with that, we will call the folks that have been so patiently waiting. Jim Russell, Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, Kevin Campbell, Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Incorporated, if you'll come up and introduce yourselves for the record. And I had Senator George, who had a question for the other panel, and Senator Troll also, and hopefully you'll be able to answer those questions that they have as well.
Well, thank you for the invitation to spend a little bit of time with you. My name is Jim Russell. And the executive for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. That is a mental health organization providing Oregon health plan mental health services in five counties around this area, Lynn, Marion, Polk, Tillamook, and Yandville counties. And Kevin, do you want me to talk or you want to introduce yourself? And
well, go ahead.
Okay. So, thank you. Rick is giving you a two-sided sheet that I happen to have with me and thought it would be helpful for you in giving you an opening understanding of what is popularly called the BCN, for the Behavioral Care Network. The BCN was formed by the five counties that I just listed to accomplish the purposes you can see on that sheet, the goals. You heard in the previous testimony that there is commitment in the healthcare sector, including the mental health care sector, to the to public service and to the high-risk populations that have typically been treated by the public sector. What those counties believed in the middle 70s, as they could see how the Oregon Health Plan would roll out, was that rather than have an outside entity be a management entity telling them how to deliver services and using some of the money to do so, that they themselves could come together and form a management entity to accomplish those purposes. And I especially would like to point to the third bullet under that goals section on the front page of that sheet, that this was a strategy to maximize the amount of revenue going into direct service. And it's been a very successful strategy. We spend probably about 3% of the Oregon Health Plan dollar for central administrative services and another 3% on the administrative for the data system to meet the management requirements in the state contract. So this entity was formed under the Council of Government statutes So it's a an intergovernmental organization, governmental entity, that contracts now with what's called the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services to provide mental health services across those five counties. There's a little more than 500,000 people in those five counties, and currently about 65,000 Oregon Health Plan members. We might provide services to 8,000 or 9,000 of those people in a given year across that region. On that back side, I want to elaborate this administrative cost benefit by drawing out that third bullet, C, actually. There are some administrative costs of an information system that could not be borne by any but the very largest of those five counties. And there's also an unevenness of expense, so that Tillamook County is about 5% of the BCN, but especially in the first year, their need for hospital care would have put them out of business if we weren't operating as a network to kind of even out that cost. So there's both the opportunity to spread the unevenness of healthcare costs, as well as to share the cost of the administration that needs to be done for the state contract. A further benefit to the members receiving services staying on that same side is the opportunity to improve access. We have services available in Marion County that aren't available in Tillamook County, except through the BCN, they do become available to that member, either directly or indirectly by the exchange of ideas and the movement of good strategies, good healthcare strategies elsewhere.
Senator Hsu.
Yeah, a quick question, just a point of comparison, I guess. How many clients do you have altogether in those five counties, and how many of them would be considered the traditional Medicaid as opposed to new eligibles?
I do have a sheet to be more accurate. I would guess that the new eligibles are about 20%.
I guess it's on this sheet on the other side. Yeah, you. Okay, thank you.
Well, I don't think it does really break out on that side. It shows you the total members, but it doesn't show you the percentage for the new eligibles.
Right, but about 20% of that 64,000 is supposedly.
Yes. Right.
Thank you.
I understood that it would be helpful for you to have some mental health organizations here to answer your questions about their role in the health plan. It really is just part of mental health services. The state has a direct contract with the counties for some state-funded services. The Oregon Health Plan are those mental health services with federal participation. You know, my thought, I'd be glad to pause for questions.
Well, let's do that. And which one of you, both of you, which one's going to Gold Beach? Somebody? Neither
Kevin.
One of you? Kevin?
Not
okay, that's fine. Well, that's fine. Let's pause and see if there are any questions at this point. I'm going to take Senator Farioli first, and then Senator Trill and Senator George.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, it's not a question. It's just an honor to have Judge Kevin Campbell here. He's a good friend of mental health services in Oregon, good friend of Eastern Oregon. And it's wonderful to have a constituent here to talk about this issue today. So I'd just like to welcome him to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Senator Trill?
My question has to do about capitation rates that we heard in the discussion last time. It seems to me that when we started all of this, people were pleased that capitation rates were such that providers were fairly well compensated. It seems to me that's the case. I know there are categories of capitation rates and so forth, but the thrust, I think, of the answers to Senator Farioli's question was that now they're terribly inadequate. At one time, I think they were much more adequate. Is that the case?
I'm not knowledgeable enough to talk across the entire Oregon Health Plan, but only in regards to mental health rates.
Okay.
And the mental health rates have not, they were flat last year, went down just a little bit, but they've not decreased since the BCN started in 97.
Well, are they generally adequate then?
I believe that the mental health rates are adequate for the Mid-Valley area. I'm not even certain to affirm that across the state.
Well, let me ask Kevin about the other capitation rates.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Senator, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today as the CEO of GOBI, Great Oregon Behavioral Health. Our offices are located in the Dalles. We serve 12 counties, 10 of which are in eastern Oregon, then Clatsop and Columbia counties here. And the capitation rate, while it has remained stable for mental health services, we've not done a good job of breaking away from the principles of fee-for-service billing and move toward the true sharing the risk and sharing the gain that was offered in the managed care environment. So we continue to count widgets and think of outcomes as units of service being delivered. What we really need to move toward is two things. Number one, having communities able to share in healthy outcomes for the population in the broadest sense of the form, meeting and exceeding Oregon benchmarks would be a good place to start. And then the second is, let's not leave any more federal money on the table than we have to. Let's find and access matchable, clean general fund dollars and provide a Medicaid match benefit to every person who's eligible for that benefit at the federal definition of it, rather than, because of budget shortfalls, cutting away 40 cents of general fund money, which then basically leaves 60 cents of federal money on the table. So that's my greatest concern at this point. And I did have a couple of prepared remarks, and they...
I don't want to keep you from those, but it seems to me that part of the problem with capitation rates is our problem of not finding enough money to put into to those rates so that they can be adequate. And I think it's a matter of priorities, We declare a whole lot of money that we've had in good times, excess money, and send it back in kicker checks that might well have gone into other kinds of programs that would make those programs adequate. We haven't done that. It's a matter of priorities, but you know, it seems to me that even if the capitation rates are not as adequate as they should be, that the amount of good that we're doing out there with getting service to people who really need it is a tremendous amount of good. But I think we ought to work on the capitation rates. We need certainly to make them adequate, and I don't think providers should be subsidizing the program. But at the same time, that's an awfully good program, and part of the problem is us in getting the money out there.
Senator, if I may respond to that.
Kevin, I've got a question from Senator George, and then maybe you can make your response to both senators.
First of all, Kevin, before I ask, I'd like to remind my colleagues that the kicker was voted into the Constitution by the citizens of Oregon, so that issue is over with. But what I would like to ask, Kevin, I think it was a perfect lead-in as to what you were answering there, and that is we are adding 40% to this plan, and with the capitation rate versus what you kind of indicate you're actually doing a fee for service anyway, how much worse off would you be if we just went to a Medicaid fee for service rate structure, or if in fact our waiver gets pulled and we're back there anyway? How what does that look like when you set those type like that?
Senator, in many of our counties, we would be out of business.
Okay.
The volume of business in a fee for service environment does not support the credentials that are necessary to treat the most difficult cases who tend to migrate to the ultra-rural communities in Oregon. I'm a native of Kimberly, Oregon. I'm a graduate of Monument High School. There is still a school there, even though it only has a third of the number of students that it did when I graduated. I like to tell people that I was in the top 25% of my graduating class and number 12 in my class. Then I went on to University of Portland, and I was in the 25% of my class that graduated, so I get that out. But the real issue that we're dealing with, though, is a fee-for-service environment is not one which we can go back to. We were driven for the Oregon Health Plan to try to contain costs and hopefully to spread the benefits to a broader population. We have indeed contained the cost. The concern I have is the money we're leaving on the table, the federal money that we could access with a broader match. And I agree with Senator Stroh, it is our problem not coming up with that match. I don't limit that, though, to the state's problem. I believe local government has a hand to play in this, too. As a former county judge in a small county, I can go back to my budget and identify dollars in Commission on Children and Families, local health departments, possibly prevention programs in the juvenile department, some of our mental health services that we funded, and certainly in some of our school programs that would be eligible for federal Medicaid match if we had a level of trust that was high enough to expose that money to an agent that could match it. There is a fundamental distrust between local and state governments. That's no secret to much of anybody. And the real issue that we have to keep thinking here is as economic units, not as layers of government or bureaucracy. I think one of the greatest opportunities we have with organizations such as ours is to work with our county commissioners and find ways to literally turn 40 cents into a dollar for target populations within their county. And in the information that I handed out to you, if we skip beyond the Dolby historical information and go to a sheet that looks like this, that says what is the DHS population in each county scattered across the state, and how many DHS employees do we have in each county across the state. And I put asterisks by the counties that are in Dolby. We have a total of 295 jobs, DHS jobs, in 11 of our 12 counties. In Umatilla County, we have 432 DHS jobs. That's largely because there's a state hospital in Umatilla County. Those are very extensive populations. What we've succeeded in doing is moving our dependence from extensive services to less intrusive and more affordable outpatient services, patient services within the community. Not 50-minute hours of therapy waiting for people to come in your door, but intensive case management where you actually go out to places like Monument, Oregon, and engage with people and keep them healthy, keep them on their medications, keep them out of jail, and hopefully keep them working. We've had a good success in doing that. Statewide, the average for expenditures for inpatient care has been 17%. At Dolby, it's 6.2%. Jim talked about his admin costs. Our admin costs are 5.8%, and that includes an MIS system. Now, what we're missing a bet on is two things. I think that we, as Health Plan to Health Plan, could do a better job of collaborating and make business decisions that put us together as an economic unit to share in some economies of scale. Mm-hmm. But I think we could also use our MIS system more effectively to demonstrate what those outcomes are within communities. We really need to be able to demonstrate to the taxpayers that we're doing a better job of investing their dollars. And the way we do that is keeping kids out of prison, keeping kids from committing suicide, seeing the kids graduate from high school, and hopefully keeping a few jobs in rural Oregon.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Kevin. Excellent testimony, excellent advice, and we'll see if we can, hopefully the proper channels are hearing your advice. I think you're right. 4 years that I was out of the process, I worked in local government, Commission on Children and Families, Juvenile Department. There's much money that could be leveraged better than what we do now. Any other questions of this panel? Not? Have a safe journey, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. I was having a perfectly nice day in the bowels of Oregon until I got a call from Gina.
Right.
Let's next we'll have Mike Shirtcliffe from the Northwest Dental Services, and we have two of you coming up, okay? I recognize Jim, come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my good friend Representative Hayden. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about the Oregon Health Plan and dentistry in the state of Oregon and how we relate to that.
And would you put your name on the record?
I'm sorry. Dr. Mike Shirtcliffe. I'm a dentist, previously born and raised in Myrtle Creek, but now live in the Senator Farno's district over by the Reindeer Farm, not too far from there. I'm the president and CEO of an organization called Northwest Dental Services, which has 270 dentists in rural Oregon and a giant cooperative that banded together to figure out how we could provide dental care for the citizens of our community, not only the poor, the rich, and all those in between. The Oregon Health Plan came along, and so we figured out a system to where we could use Governor Kitzhaber's ration, prioritized managed care, in a way that would allow us to provide enough money to the providers so that they would participate in a system that had no access to care when we had the old Medicaid system. We presently have 72,000 Oregon Health Plan people, all of them, and with the exception of a few in Eugene, I mean, actually in Cottage Grove, most of them are in rural counties. We have patients, Oregon Health Plan recipients in 21 rural counties. We have none in the Willamette Valley. I've never understood the Willamette Valley. I apologize to those of you from the Willamette Valley, but I'm from rural Oregon.
No offense taken.
I'm from rural Oregon, and dentistry has been on the cusp, so to speak, and it always is on the cusp, because unless you have a toothache, dentistry is considered to be some kind of a luxury that people don't need. If you have a toothache, which my good colleague and sitting next to me had the opportunity to experience here last month for 3 weeks, and you couldn't go to work because you had a toothache, unless you have a toothache and have suffered from a toothache, it's supposed to be optional. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the issues. I also have experience. My company is contracted with the Oregon Health Plan for 6 years. We have 16 capitation rates for people 0 to 1 year old. We get 2 cents a month for patients. And so we're both, and the elderly poor, we get something like $36. But what we do is we take all those cap rates, mix them all together, and see if we can make sense to pay our providers in a way that they can actually deliver the care. I would hate to think what would happen to the citizens of rural Oregon if they didn't have a system like the Oregon Health Plan. Most of those people used to have dads who worked in the mill, or my dad did. My mother never graduated from high school. My grandfather was an itinerant, a sheep herder, got out of the fourth grade. My mom had a dream that her kids could go to college. And I don't know, because most of those people had a job. I was sitting in a group of loggers at on the farewell party for one of the loggers here the other day. And I looked around the room, and there were 60 guys that we'll never see again. They all were guys that pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, went to work every morning, and provided for their families, and their passing grief. Personally, you can tell I'm sad about it. Because wealth comes from toiling the soil in some way. And what we have is, I'm reading the paper in Crimeville the other day, and everybody's happy that the federal government's put in a welfare clinic for all the people who used to have a job. They could go down and pay for their own dental needs and medical needs. Well, they don't do it anymore. They got a handout from the feds. You wonder what's wrong with the Oregon Health Plan? Very frankly, dentistry was asked, and I'm going to give you this, what Jim and I talked about. Dentistry was asked, how can we provide the services in a way that gives good services for less money? Because the state, we need to do it as efficiently as possible. We did that. We took a 50% cut off the expansion of adults, put a program together that will work. The citizens will get the care they need to keep them out of trouble and out of the hospitals. And we, the dental plans, will be able to administrate that plan in a way that makes sense. The problem we have is I'm sitting here before a bureaucracy who's regulated by OMAP, which is a bureaucracy, which is regulated by CFS, which is a bureaucracy. I think I forgot one. I think I forgot one bureaucracy. So, there, you know, and I was listening here a while back to Mikhail Gorbachev, and somebody asked him, why did the Soviet Union finally collapse? And he said, because the weight of the bureaucracy got so heavy, we just couldn't do it anymore, get anything done. And part of what you have going on in the Oregon Health Plan is you've got so many layers of bureaucracy that would be very easy to cut through. But the problem was, and what's happened since I started in this program, it used to be a partnership between business and government, where government trusts business and business trusts government, and we set out to do something good for the citizens of Oregon. And we did it. I don't know what about your politics are, but Governor Kitzhaber is right when he says there's not enough health care providers to go around. We have to have a system to ration it. Unfortunately, that whole system is bogged down in bureaucracy. I mean, the stuff that I have to do to just to get the job done. In fact, I know the other layer of bureaucracy is my own. You pay me 8% to administrate something that you check on me to administrate that somebody else checks somebody else to administrate. So we in dentistry made it more efficient. We were asked to take a 20% cut. We did that. We were asked to take a 50% cut. We did that. That was either that or get eliminated, because what came out of the first special session was to eliminate dentistry for everybody under 25, 21. Well, in rural Oregon, I don't know what we'd do out there for health care. I mean, I'd like to see us back logging and farming and fishing and gold mining and all the stuff we used to do, but I don't know if we're going to go back to those days. So I don't know what those people are going to do. I don't know about socialism. Somebody bigger than me decided a long time ago that socialistic health care works, which doesn't work anywhere else. I don't know if it's going to work here. But if we could have a partnership where we trusted each other in Oregon and we could actually lay down our swords, and try to do what's effective, not what's partisan, I think we could do, and we did that for a while. So anyway, we eliminated 20%, eliminated 50%. I can show you how to save another $6 million biennium in the categoricals. I could probably cut the 50% out a little bit more and a little more efficiency, but I can only do so much on my side. And I feel like that to eliminate that billing program, which when the dentists have stood up to the plate and delivered, I think, a great product. And we've done it without a raise in 4 years. And we get paid about the same thing, because I run a commercial insurance company also, about the same dollar per month that commercial insurance is. The problem we have now is the fact that people are out there turning dentists over to the board because they can't get it fast enough. Well, this is rationed, prioritized, managed health care. And so you have one set of layers of regulations that the state has, and then you have another set of regulations that the feds have. And the feds are more socialistic than the states, and so you get this confusion going on all the time about how do you administrate the program. So dentistry is a good program. I think it's one of the, I think the Oregon Health Plan has been successful. I think it's gotten out of control because of, very frankly, we need a good manager. Not that they haven't done a good job, but we need somebody that just actually can manage it. And in fact, I think if you turn the Oregon Health Plan over to private business and actually could trust them, have a system to check on them and make sure that it gets done correctly, that they could be a lot more efficient. I mean, we run our program, we cover 72,000 people with 21 people, just 21 of us. And so, anyway, I need to see you eliminate dentistry. I know you've got a tough, daunting task before you. I mean, I've been to every special session. I hope that this is bigger than just this session, because I think dentistry would like to embrace the legislature in a way that we could continue to have a decent health care program. We don't want an ostentatious one. We want one that works, that we could administer, that allows people not to suffer toothaches, that's streamlined down, but we also want to be able to continue to exist, and to exist in a way that we can continue forward, or at least know when you're going to end it so that we can prepare for that too. So this, one or the other. And I hate to say that because Jim gets nervous, because it all looks a little, but we really think we have a good program and we've done our part. We think, and the other thing I've had experience is I've watched the administration and I watched some of the other bureaucracy in the rest of the healthcare system, and very frankly, I think there are some savings that the other folks could do in places that would make a more effective program.
Mike, thank you very much, and I'm glad you live in my district. If you run for something, I'll vote for you. If you live near the reindeer farm, I live at Eagle Crest. We're not very far from one another. Nice to have you here today, and appreciate your frank, open, and honest testimony. Really do. Senator Ferrioli?
Madam Chair and members, if I could just have one point very briefly, and then...
Jim Hayes.
Okay, no. I wonder, Senator, do you have a question from Mike first?
Madam Chairman, just why do you need 16 cap rates?
It doesn't matter how many you need. I mean, what they do is they...
Well, I mean, why not?
They try to wait...
Why not four?
My opinion, okay? My opinion. They try to wait how much care is needed. Well, how much is it going to take to care for that person? And, you know, if it's care for... how many times is a newborn going to go to the dentist? Unless there's an accident, probably never. And so, they give you 2 cents for that cap rate. But somebody who's elderly poor in a nursing home, that's $36. And so they weight it actually, legitimately, in a way that puts the weight on what the cost of care is. I can't speak for medicine because I just do that dentist. But in our place, we got $27 for adults and adults. That's the one we cut in half. That's a little higher than commercial, but they give us a $12 for a kid who is screaming. So you've got to balance that. We just month them together, get a rate that we can actually do, and go from there.
Madam Chair.
I'm hoping, Senator Ferrioli, I want you to go ahead with your question in a moment, but we have Dr. Balmer here. I'm hoping he can answer the medical part of your question because I believe you can only answer the dental part of it. And we have Kevin Earls coming from the hospital, so maybe we can get a little better idea of how the rate...
Well, just one observation, and then I'm through with the line of questions. What I'm hearing is that in practical sense, the practitioners and the care providers simply average the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 16 cap rates. They have one. You know, they're looking at the total spectrum of coverage and making a decision about how they're going to allocate the services under those cap rates, but the fact of the matter is their unit cost is their average cost.
Right.
Thank you, Mr.
Good point. Any other questions? Not. Thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Jim, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn, representing Northwest Dental Services. Just wanted to make two quick points. When you cut 50% from the expansion group, there are services that are delayed, there are services that are not available, there are services that have co-pays. There is a downside to that. That was one thing you weigh compared to losing the services altogether. So it's not a simple task. But the other part is OMAP initially said you're going to have a 50% co-pay. They identified the savings. They came in and said, here's how you're going to do it. And it would have been a complete failure. Because providers, Dr. Shirkwith and others, got together and said, if there is a 50% copay on this program that goes forward, let us instead design a program that will work for 50 cents on the dollar and design one that has the least harm to the client, to the patient. And that has been a success, and that's an example of what the legislature needs to look at. And if savings have to be identified, ask the providers to come in with the package to do it. Do not allow the bureaucracy to drive the savings. Allow the providers who are dealing with the individuals to say, this is how you can make the savings reach the target with the least harm for the person we're treating.
Thank you, Jim. Any other questions or comments? Thank you both very much. Next we'll have Kevin Earls, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Earls. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Health Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals. And I wanted to start by thanking you for your willingness, I guess, to consider problems of access in the Oregon Health Plan at a time when the state is already facing such significant budget pressures and revenue shortfalls. In many ways, I think it is tough to add to your load, but there are problems that are so endemic to the Oregon Health Plan that relate to access and payment that perhaps it's the best time to think about the changes that need to be made now with an eye towards the future when those changes can be implemented financially. My comments this afternoon will be brief and directed to the ways in which the state's Medicaid payment system, in our opinion, needs to be improved to facilitate that access that you're seeking to encourage while minimizing the cost shift to the private sector and the majority of Oregonians who receive their health insurance coverage from commercial plans and private employers. I wanted to start with what I think is one of the most important founding principles of the Oregon Health Plan, and his language is found in statute, and I'll paraphrase because I'm not going to get it right, but to pay providers at rates sufficient to cover the cost of caring for Medicaid patients. And that really has always implied that the state would pay for the actual cost of care, that paying for less than the cost of care meant that we were having to shift those costs somewhere else. And because there are only really three payers in the healthcare system, Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial insurance, and we can't cost shift to Medicare, it meant that every dollar that we underpay in Medicaid gets shifted directly into the rates that the majority of Oregonians pay through the commercial healthcare delivery system. So that was really, I think, a key founding principle. And that principle always made sense to us because we knew that we could leverage federal dollars in a tremendous leveraging ratio. And so that is, you know, the framework that I work from. We also believe that we could found managed care plans in most communities throughout Oregon to help control the cost of the Oregon Health Plan. And I think that has been successful in many communities. It has had its challenges, as we heard from Care Org in some of our bigger communities. And there are certainly many areas of the state in which managed care plans do not and probably will not exist. With that kind of as a backdrop, I wanted to spend a couple minutes, really the body of my comments, talking about the payment systems, the two different payment systems that affect hospitals and other providers in the Oregon Health Plan, and to draw a sharp distinction between those two systems, one being the managed care kind of capitated rate system, and the other being distinct and separate from that, the fee-for-service payment system. The managed care system was designed, the managed care capitated rate payment system was designed to facilitate those managed care contracts and health plans that could be formed around the state. And the state uses, as you know, an actuarial firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and PricewaterhouseCoopers and the state's own administrative people meet periodically and regularly with representatives from the health plan to help gather the data in order for the state to build the capitation rate for the coming contract year period. That process, despite the many hours that go into it, is frankly not well understood by the health plans. They feel like the capitated rate process, the formula or the methodology that's used for developing capitated payment rates, from which they must survive, is kind of a black box. And they have experienced, many of them, many successive years of losses on the Oregon Health Plan business. They have worked diligently with the state, I believe, to try and understand the methodology so that they can, in effect, recreate the calculations for themselves and proof it so that they feel like they understand where they're losing money or how they need to recalibrate in order to work effectively under those systems. And we've seen recent events that the frustration level with the inability to decipher the contents of the black box has led to litigation and threatens really the very existence of the managed care delivery system that is one portion of the Oregon Health Plan. So under capitation, I would say there are kind of a few issues. First of all, not being able to replicate the calculation, that black box. That, you know, that has to see the open air, and people need to fully understand how to do that in order for the right kinds of trusts to occur with the partners in the plan, in the Oregon Health Plan. The second thing that needs to be addressed is, you know, are the payments that are in the capitated rate fundamentally adequate in order to meet those true costs of caring for Medicaid patients? You know, I can't tell you whether they are or not. But what I know is they don't appear to be. And the reason that I think they don't appear to be is what happens is when that capitated payment amount goes to the health plan then turns around and sits down with different provider groups, dentists, hospitals, doctors, and so forth, and they have to meet out the portions of that capitated rate to the partners. And frankly, when all the participants get together, there isn't enough money for all the participants to cover their costs. And what ends up happening is infighting. You know, it's like having a bunch of hungry kids at the table and you don't have enough food. You know, there's going to be friction, and that's happening in the managed care side. Now, I'll shift to the fee-for-service side because I actually think that's the bigger piece of the problem. The fee-for-service rate methodology doesn't have any connection to the managed care rate methodology in this state. And I'm not arguing that it necessarily has to, but it does. The fee-for-service, speaking for hospitals for a moment, when you think about hospital payments, there are two categories that hospitals are paid for under the Oregon Health Plan. One is for inpatient services for people hospitalized, the other is for outpatient. In both instances, the methodology that's used to pay to calculate the fee-for-service rates for hospitals in Oregon ties to what's called a Medicare cost report, which is a standardized way of collecting cost data on hospitals in the country. Every hospital files one. And they file them every year. The cost report data that the state of Oregon uses to calculate fee-for-service rates is 1986. Now, if you think about hospitals and how far they've come in the last 16 years and how they physically look different, how the kind of medicine they're practicing, the types of equipment that they have, how many beds they've had to add, how they've had to change from inpatient to more outpatient and so forth, they've completely changed how they look from 1986. So that's a problem. The second problem is that every year that goes by, costs naturally go up, as they do in any business. And healthcare costs often go up more quickly than in other, because of the aging of America, and we're spending more on technology and drugs and so forth. The updates to the fee-for-service rates that are added to that original base year methodology are done periodically. That's putting it kindly. But what that means is they're not done annually. Some years there is no update. And there is no calculation for how that occurs. It's, I would say, arbitrary. And they've been minimal over the whole span of the Oregon Health Plan. So those updates have not kept pace with the kinds of inflation that providers have seen. Now, I'm just going to close with the most stark example I can give. On the outpatient side for hospitals, they take their actual cost of providing care, and then the state multiplies that times 0.59, meaning that the state pays 59 cents on the dollar of the cost of providing care to Medicaid patients. So every time we see a patient in an outpatient setting, we lose 41% of the cost of providing care to that person. And I'll close with just one kind of fact that we tried to exercise in the discussion of the development of 2519 and the waiver expansion process, because we feel that if you're going to expand the health plan, which we think is a laudable goal and important, and as an organization we support it, but it must be built on a secure financial foundation. In Oregon, and this is based on data that's available from the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research, in Oregon, Oregon hospitals discharge about 45,000 Medicaid patients per year. We lose just about $2,000 per discharge on a Medicaid patient. So, you know, those costs are enormous. They're shifted directly to the private sector, and two-thirds of those costs, in effect, are potential federal match that we forego. So I'll stop there, and if there are questions, I'd be happy to try and answer.
Thank you, Kevin. Any questions? Senator George.
Kevin, that's a little bit startling to think about, that you calculate your actual cost and you get 0.59% of that back. When the whole purpose of this was to end the cost shifting. Yeah, it looks like we're a long ways away from getting even to the point where you wouldn't be able to cost shift. But my question is kind of relative to that, and in fact, is relative to that, and that is, before you were under a system like this, and you had someone that might be considered to be very needy and unable to pay the full cost, you could, in fact, try to work out some sort of payment methodology in which they might be able to repay some of the cost of the hospital. Under this plan, once you've taken 0.59%, you have no recourse whatsoever to try to achieve any sort of recoup other than to pass it on to the private. Is that correct?
Senator George, we accept that payment in full. And, and I would also tell you that 95% of Oregon hospitals are not-for-profit, and virtually every hospital in the state has a well-defined, increasingly well-defined, charity care policy for providing care to patients that don't have the means to pay for themselves. And we put Medicaid patients in that class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of our part of our charitable mission.
Thank you. Kevin, just to clarify the $2,000, is that an average? Does that encompass the type AB hospital reimbursements in rural, and just kind of aggregate it and average it, or?
It is. It does. It's aggregate data for the statewide. All hospital types, all Medicaid discharges. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. I believe this is the first time, Mr. Earls, that I've heard testimony from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in my career. And so I have a couple of questions just to help me understand more about the mission of the organization you represent. What is the mission of the association? And then also you referenced the charity care policy of the association. Could you expand on that and tell me what is that policy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems is an association made up of the 62 hospitals licensed in the state of Oregon. And we work primarily in advocacy roles on behalf of community hospitals, with state agencies, the state legislature, as in this forum, the federal government. We work on issues like Medicare payment policy at the federal level. We work, last session, for instance, we were involved with a payment legislation that dealt with prompt payment of medical bills from commercial insurance companies. So we do primarily advocacy, but our organization also has a foundation, 501c3 foundation, that last year helped develop a computer financial model to help Oregon hospitals evaluate conversion to what is called critical access hospital status, which would permit them under federal law to get higher levels of reimbursement and stabilize those hospitals that are located in rural areas. So that's really the organization's mission, or a sample of it. With regard to the charity care policy, those are not a policy of the association, but rather of the individual hospitals they develop them primarily to meet the needs of their local community.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, in general, what do those policies say?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I would be hard-pressed to characterize all of them because I'm only familiar with a few of them. I know that our organization has worked closely with the Oregon Health Action Campaign primarily to develop kind of standardized charity care policies here in the Willamette Valley and in the Portland area. I think all the hospitals in the Portland area and three or four in the Valley all participate in that. And my recollection is that they agreed to provide financial assistance to everyone who is below 150% of the federal poverty level, and they generally write off anything for someone who is below 100% of the federal poverty level.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
you.
Right, I just want to, they generally write off for
If I may, just one I think important point of clarification. Every hospital has this charitable mission.
Can you speak up, Kevin? Some people are having a hard time hearing you.
Unbelievable. every hospital has, or I believe every hospital has, a written charitable care policy. But the point that I'd like to make is hospitals would like to be able to use those charitable mission dollars that they make available that in part stem from their classification as a tax-exempt, not-for-profit hospital. They would like to be able to use those to reach and provide care for people who don't have insurance. And to the degree that the state underpays for Medicaid, they end up, in effect, subsidizing the state of Oregon for a program that the state is running. So what we'd like to see is free those dollars up. And if someone comes in that doesn't have private health insurance and isn't qualified for the Medicaid program, then those charitable dollars are available for that person. Thank you.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin, you must have anticipated my question because it looks to me like a good portion of just what, $90 million, a shortfall?
Yes.
Is you're giving charity to the state of Oregon. And my question is that I can remember last session when we saw a printout of what each state got per person, basically from the federal government payment, only to find out that here we were, way down here, really low per person. I said, why is this way? And they said, well, because we offer efficient care. So we could penalize for being efficient? The answer was, well, yeah. My question for you, you had made a statement that if, in fact, you had a closer to cost if you received payment that was close to your cost, that you might actually then be able to leverage other dollars. Is that correct? Is there how would that formula kick in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, my point was this, that when the state cost shifts in the Medicaid program, if I can use round numbers and say that it's a two-thirds federal match, then, you know, the third that is basically all three-thirds get shifted to the private sector.
So you don't get the two-thirds match on that.
Right. And my point is that, you know, that is directly contrary to the founding principle of the Oregon Health Plan, which was, why would we ever want to cost shift onto the private sector when for every $3 that we cost shift, we're only saving a buck?
Okay. And that was my point. I think everyone here needs to be thinking about that because I think that's probably the most shocking thing about, you know, as a novice becoming aware of how the system works, and you wonder, well, why would we continue to do that? And when, in fact, the federal government just reduces it down the more you shift it. Thank you.
Of course, that's kind of a paradox, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that somebody has to pay for it. So you either put more tax dollars in it, reduce the shift, or you increase the shift, and the federal government reduces the, you know, it's like stepping on one end of the balloon. You know, one gets smaller, the other gets bigger, back and forth.
Mr. Chairman, conservative Republican, believe me, I understand that. But when I see some other state where I know is much better off than we are, I wouldn't mind them at least coming up to an equal with us in the level of suffering.
Now, is that problem more of a federal distribution problem than it is? I mean, in other words, it's the way, it's a federal policy issue.
Chairman, the issue with regard to Medicaid is a state-only problem. The federal match rate is established by the level of per capita income in each state. And so we happen to get a fairly healthy match rate from the federal government because we have a relatively low per capita income relative to other states. Just to differentiate that, Senator George made mention of we are a relatively efficient state. We don't hospitalize people as much here as we do as happens in other states. And their length of stay, once they're in the hospital, is shorter. We tend to have a pretty efficient hospital delivery system. And the point that Senator George was making is on the Medicare side, not Medicaid, but Medicare, we tend to get punished for that because states that have a relatively efficient delivery system don't do as well on the federal Medicare payment side. But that doesn't affect the Medicaid program.
All right. I'm going to go back in history a little bit. Years ago in the late 80s, for meds, past late 80s, we used to have a certificate of need process for the building of hospitals, expansion of hospitals, and such on and so forth. And we did away with that. And help me understand what I'm seeing with the expansion of medical facilities, and particularly hospital expansion. It seems, at least in the Portland metropolitan area, when I look around, I see hospitals getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And is that directly related to the population growth in Oregon? Or, you know, if we're becoming more efficient in terms of hospital stays and minimizing hospitalization, why is it such that we need so much capacity within the hospital system?
Sure, Matt. There are a number of factors that are driving construction in our industry, but let me touch on two of them. You mentioned the population growth, and that's certainly a factor, but the aging of the population is a factor. As the whole baby boom factors through, we see older people using hospital services at a greater rate. But the other thing that I think contributes to the construction costs at hospitals is what we see as a point of service or site of service change. There is a migration from inpatient to outpatient in the hospital industry, and it's been going on for many years. It's much less expensive to provide care in an outpatient setting. But in many hospitals' situations, they need to retool and develop an outpatient facility to get someone in to do day surgery and get them back out. They don't have to keep them overnight. It keeps the cost lower. But they have to build a different kind of facility that's more of a clinic style. And for instance, down the street from here, Salem Hospital recently completed a building that is bridged to their main building where physicians come and they have an office there that has access to an outpatient surgical suite and so forth. So those types of factors are all contributing.
Well, and I'm trying to understand this in the context of medical economics, that there's such a phrase. We look at cost drivers for healthcare. Hospitalization is one of the key components there. To the extent that you're building or overbuilding capacity, you have infrastructure that needs to be paid for. How do hospitals gauge the need for expansion, and how do they do their cash flow model to determine how many patients have to be coming through the door that are paying, and how many patients need to be coming through their Medicaid or Medicare patients? I'm assuming that you've got CPAs or other folks that sit around and try to figure out what those models look like and try to meet your expenses. Or how does that happen?
We have CSPs. Mr. Chair, certifiably smart people. Actually, we collect a tremendous amount of data. And Senator Gordley asked about the functions of our association. One of the things that we do is collect a patient record on every single person that's hospitalized in this state. So we collect about, I think it's 85 data points on each individual person that's admitted to a hospital. And it helps us understand what kind of services are being utilized, how long do they take, what are the demographics of the population they're using the services and so forth. That data is able to be analyzed in a way that helps to, create appropriate planning mechanisms, because the length of time to execute the construction of facilities and so forth is fairly lengthy. So we have to have good data for hospitals to be able to make those kinds of business decisions.
Okay, so you have a fairly sophisticated collection system for data, and I assume there are various assumptions relevant to what those data points mean in terms of cost.
Well, Senator Minnis, the cost information comes straight off of the annually filed Medicare cost report. It's an enormous report about the size of the Portland phone book that each hospital must generate each year and file with the federal government. It's publicly available. It breaks down the individual components of hospitals' capital, overhead, education, and so forth costs, so that, in effect, one of the things that can happen is the federal government can take some of those costs and exclude them from the reimbursement process. For instance, you know, as an example, if a hospital refinances some debt, some of the costs of refinancing that debt are excluded in the Medicare cost report calculation in terms of what's called allowable cost. So even though that's a real cost for the facility, it won't be used in the calculation for in the Medicare cost report for reimbursement for Medicare services in the coming year. So that's where the cost information stems from. The kind of information I was talking about is really utilization information. The kinds of services, frequency, geographic location, and so forth. And I would suggest that hospitals have not been a cost driver in the Oregon Health Plan. And I would validate my assertion as follows. First of all, on the fee-for-service side, again, going back to the two components, on the fee-for-service side, we're statutorily paid 59% of our costs on outpatient. And on the inpatient side in fee-for-service, there's a variation from facility to facility statewide, but the range is kind of in the 20% to 80 or 85% of costs on inpatient. Now, there are some very small rural facilities that are exceptions to that. And then on the managed care side, in the capitated rate setting process, OMAP put out, and I have available for the committee if you'd like, a historical look at the seven or so components that go into building the managed care rate for each biennium. That's the hospital fees, the physician fees, the dentist, the prescription drugs, mental health, and I think is what it is. And if you look at the component that goes into that cap rate that is allocated to hospitals, it is like dead flat since 1994.
So when you say dead flat, meaning what?
Meaning it has, on a per member per month basis, it has virtually not increased at all. I mean, I think it went up a little bit last biennium, but it's still probably in the under 5% increase on a per member per month basis going back to 1994.
Well, let me ask you, I want to switch gears just a second. The hospitals purchase a lot of prescription medications, do they not?
Yes.
And they're passed out to the patients as they're prescribed
while they're
in the hospital. Now, the hospitals, what rate do they buy prescription medications? And let me kind of give you the background for this. At a recent conference I was at, it was told to me that physicians, particularly in the areas of oncology, where medications are prescribed or administered in their offices, are able to buy prescription medications at 20% of AWP, but they're reimbursed at 80% of AWP, so there's a 60% spread. Now, is that true for hospitals also? Do you buy at 20% of AWP and reimburse at a higher rate by the federal government?
Chair Minutes, I honestly don't have that. I don't know. I'd be happy to provide the committee with an answer, but I don't have it right now.
Well, I'd like to know the answer because I know that particularly the conference that I was at, it sounds rather inflammatory to say a physician can buy it at 20% of AWP. They're reimbursed at 80% of AWP, so you've got a 60% spread. And as it was presented in the conference, Congress is fully aware that this is the case, and they justify it because they acknowledge that the Medicaid reimbursement is generally low. So on one side, they're saying we're short-cheating you on costs here, but we're going to give it back to you as you purchase your medications for a much less price. So I'm just trying to determine whether or not that might be true for medications purchased by hospitals and if you're reimbursed at higher, because that would be a subsidy area, in essence, for the hospital.
It would, and I'd be happy to get the answer.
Okay, thank you. Rick.
Thank you, Senator. Kevin, just a question back on the health care drivers and the hospital's kind of contribution to health care costs. I know a couple of national sources identified hospitals actually outpaced pharmaceuticals last year in terms of overall. But what you said is it basically just has been flat just for the OHP factor within as a cost driver, not overall. It seems like what you said is that hospitals really weren't a driver.
Yes. In effect, what I'm saying is that you have two ways to get paid under the OHP, fee-for-service and managed care. On the fee-for-service side, we're statutorily low, 59% of cost on the outpatient, similarly low on the inpatient. On the managed care side, when you look at the component, the kind of the buckets that go into making the overall capitation rate that is used, if you look at the hospital-only component and adjust it for changes in enrollment from year to year, that per member per month cost has not changed much.
All right. Any other questions? Just a quick one. Does technology play a role in some of the costs for hospitals?
Technology plays a significant role.
It seems to me that there's all kinds of new gizmos being created for diagnosis, et cetera, and those costs, how do you recoup those costs? Do you buy an expensive machine, an MRI machine? I don't know what they cost, a million plus, I assume.
Well, Chairman, the accounting mechanism which is used is a straight line depreciation on individual items based on a standardized depreciation schedule that's used nationally, so that every hospital that buys machine X depreciates it on a straight line basis based on the same schedule.
Mm-hmm. How does that fit in the nonprofit category, though, in terms of accounting?
You've reached the perimeter of my knowledge.
Yeah, okay. Well, I won't push it any more because I've definitely surpassed my level of knowledge. And liability questions in terms of liability questions for physicians and hospitals. Is that increasing? Are those costs filling up for your hospital members?
Our hospitals, Chairman, our hospitals are seeing the same kinds of liability cost increases. It's a major factor for us. It is also the effect on physicians with the liability crisis has a direct bearing in terms of the kind of patients that we see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're seeing and hearing a lot about, for instance, physicians in OB practices getting out of that practice because of the cost of liability.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, that has implications for prenatal treatment and for patients showing up that haven't had adequate access to physician service.
And I keep hearing these horror stories like one you just mentioned, OB docs getting out of practice and particularly affecting rural areas. And I don't know as a policymaker what we can do about that, but it seems that it's something we should be keeping our eyes on.
Mr. Chair, I have taken a lot of your time, but you actually have triggered one or two things that I would contribute kind of in this
area. One, and this isn't directly to the liability issue, but, you know, it's another element of the underpayment, the impact of underpayment. And I don't know, because I couldn't hear very well in the back of the room, this might have been addressed, but hospitals, by law and by practice, don't turn away patients. So when someone shows up, we treat them. But in many instances, the payments to physicians in this state are so low that physicians have to make changes to their patient mix. They're not required by law to see every Medicaid patient that wants to see them. And consequently, they make what I think are entirely defensible decisions to modify their mix of patients so that they can keep their doors open, which means they limit their Medicaid patient mix. When that happens, what we see and what we are seeing throughout the state is a spike in our emergency room visits, in our emergency room utilization. Our emergency room capacity is limited. Consequently, what we're finding now is in many Portland area hospitals, there are several days a week when emergency rooms are what are on what is called divert status, meaning that they can no longer accept emergency room patients because they're at capacity. So one of the things that needs to happen in terms of access, again, back to the point of this committee, is the physician payments have got to be adequate so that physicians have an incentive to practice and see Medicaid patients. Otherwise, it just, you've talked about stepping on one end of the balloon. It's much like that in this mechanism. The other point that I would make is that you mentioned rural areas, and you know the DRG, or excuse me, the Medicaid managed care rate setting process follows one track, and the fee for service rate has followed another track that has not increased much since the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan. But consequently, those rates have gone like this. And in effect, what happens is in rural markets where there isn't a managed care plan, physicians and hospitals are paid on a fee-for-service basis. Those fee-for-service rates are so low that, you know, it is just punishing any practitioner, any physician in a rural community, because they're getting paid at rates that are way too low for them to be able to break even on their costs. Mm-hmm. Sorry to, I think those are important things for access in rural communities.
All right, good. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, one way that practitioners do compensate when they're only getting paid half the fee, they will see twice the patients in the time available, which does not make for particularly good medicine. It does keep the doors open, and people do get seen, but not at the quality level that we might hope.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in the whole issue of liability because, obviously, if you, let's say you're taking twice as many patients into your practice in an attempt to keep your cash flow working so you can keep your practice open, your exposure is assumedly larger. And if you have a problem, then you basically are running a huge risk, I assume, unless you've structured yourself such that you're impenetrable to suit. It's hard to do.
Chair Menace, I know that one of my colleagues in the association, Glenn Dayton, our general counsel, recently executed a survey of our members about the liability issue. That's really a subject that she is on point for us. I'd be happy to, in addition to the information about prescription drugs, see if I can obtain a copy of that information in summary fashion for the committee.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, although I know that I think the governor's got a task force on liability issues and whatnot, so we can also kind of couple into what that group is pulling together in terms of information. Can you do me a favor, and that is, you, I assume, have graphs and charts and things like that that pretty much back up and document what you're saying. I don't know if it's in one published document or more. Could you provide that information to the committee? And I would appreciate that. Senator George.
Just one more information request, Kevin. That's good. Could you give us a comparison between, say, the average of liability risk for 100 patients or so on the Oregon Health Plan versus, say, a private plan? Is there any difference there? I'm real curious about that. And if you don't have it, don't worry about it. But I thought if you had a comparison like that.
Senator George, I'm not sure if we can produce that, but I'll try.
Okay.
We'll
try.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate your time. Okay, and next up is, take me in the right direction. Okay, Dean and Greta, is that correct? Greta? And Mr. Ballmer? Dr. Ballmer? Is Dr. Davis out there? Okay, we'll get to you in just a second. As soon as we're done here, we'll get to you. You're last up, unfortunately, if you can be patient with us. Okay, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for having us, Chairman. My name is Dean Andretta. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Marion Polk Community Health Plan. And just to give you a quick history of our organization, Marion Polk Community Health Plan is a limited liability corporation that was created specifically for the Oregon Health Plan. The sole member of it is the Mid-Valley Independent Physician Association, which is a group of 450 doctors in Marion and Polk counties. Pretty much all the doctors that are not associated to Kaiser in our community here. We have been an Oregon Health Plan contractor since May of 2001. And got in the Oregon Health Plan business when Regent Oregon left the Oregon Health Plan. We have almost 30,000 patients within our plan at this point, and it has grown precipitously over the last year. Of that, about 9,000 Center Shields are the expansion population.
Thank you.
The OHP family and adults. What I'd like to talk about is what has worked for us, where we would like, just to kind of give you some feedback on, I think, what has worked. I'd like to speak to the cost shifting discussion that's gone on a bit as well. But as a contractor with the Oregon Health Plan, our responsibility is, one of our main responsibilities is access. We fight the access and deal with access every day. And our organization is run by the physicians in our community, and they all participate. All 450 doctors participate. Does that mean that they're all open? No. So we do have our challenges with access, particularly in a environment where it's more and more difficult to recruit physicians to Oregon. And we also have a significant malpractice liability issue going on, which affects access in particular specialties. So, however, that being said, we have fought and are winning the battle of access. Anybody who needs a primary care physician in Marion Polk County can get one. We can get one today for them. If the Oregon Health Plan goes away, that will not happen. The physicians are empowered and are responsible for this population, and the model that Oregon Health Plan has metamorphosized into are a provider organization, largely from Portland to where you have Care Oregon, Tuolumne, Family Care, Providence, all the way down to Klamath Falls. These are provider-run organizations, and that is, in my estimation, the most effective way to ensure access, ensure delivery of care, to come up with creative ways on a community-by-community basis. And each community is different. We all have our own differences with our hospital providers and in dealing with the various aspects of that. But this model has put that responsibility in the provider's hands, and I think it has proven to be very successful. And that's what I want to reiterate is this model is one that is the best shot at access, if that's what we're talking about today. Oregon Health Plan goes away. We're back to a period of time where access to the emergency room. And I am pretty sure that I can speak for most of the other health plans in that regard. In terms of the cost shifting, I want to speak to a bit. I want to go back to prior to Oregon Health Plan. And prior to Oregon Health Plan, we didn't have as many people covered. We have expanded population, and that's what we're struggling with, I think, here in terms of there's a lot more dollars in this beast than it was in the beginning, and that's because more people are covered. And prior to Oregon Health Plan, the people who were uninsured was probably at least prior to Oregon Health Plan, I worked for a hospital facility. The hospital facility at that point in time had 10% of the care was charity because the patients were not insured. After Oregon Health Plan and up till now, it's 2%. 2% of the care is uncompensated at least that's what the last report for. I want to stand shoulder to shoulder with the hospital providers and come up with solutions. But I get a little frustrated about the cost shifting because I think Oregon Health Plan has done a tremendous amount to address the cost shifting issue from the beginning of the plan till now. And an expansion of the Oregon Health Plan would continue to do that, even though there are co-pays and things of that nature coming on. And that's kind of what I wanted to say about the cost shifting issue, is that it is not perfect. There is cost shifting that continues to go on because there is differential payment. There is less payment for Medicaid patients. There is a little bit more for Medicare, and there is a lot more for Medicaid. But there is very little for people without insurance. And so there is a management of that process. What we have available to us are creating ways within our organization to deal with funding that's available. And we watch very carefully and are very careful stewards. The physicians in our organization are very careful stewards of the healthcare dollar. And, we are going to do our best to make it work. And we want to offer solutions. I want to take the dentist and have the Oregon Health Plan medical contractors come to you and help in the budget crisis. And I am sure that all the providers in our area want to do that. And so that's kind of where we are as a plan. And I think that we have stumbled on a very good delivery system, a model for delivery system. Is the financing perfect? Absolutely not. Is the pathway perfect? No. Is it transparent? No. Is it complicated? Absolutely. But is the model working? I think it is. And I think it's been extremely beneficial to the vulnerable populations in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Sir, excuse me. I was going to ask you a question, but I'm diverting this center very early. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard earlier that there were 16 different cap rates for dental services, Mr. Chairman, and I guess what I was curious about is how many different entities do you work with? One of the doctors told me in a hallway conversation that he had 11 different HMOs or 11 different entities that he worked with. Mm-hmm. I was just curious to know how many entities that you work with in this.
Well, Dell IFDA has contracts with 10 separate health plans. They're commercial HMO, PPO, privatized Medicare, HMO Medicare plan, and the Oregon Health Plan.
And, Mr. Chairman, follow-up. Do all 10 have different rates of reimbursement?
Generally not. The commercial plans have a fee schedule. There are a couple different fee schedules there, but they're largely materially the same. The Medicare plans have a very similar fee schedule. And the Oregon Health Plan has a fee.
Okay.
So there's really three different pieces.
Three different kind of gross levels.
Right.
Okay. When, Mr. Chairman, when you have unrecovered costs, how do you handle that? I mean, if you have low reimbursements under the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid,
you still have the cost. You just have to shift those costs. How do you handle that internally? Who pays for them? Unrecovered costs.
Well, physician, it basically gets down to the physician office. And there is a payer mix, which is very paid very well attention to. You know, the physicians need to manage that such that at the end it all comes out. Now, the view generally on Oregon Health Plan is that, and again, it varies very greatly practice by practice. We have particular clinics that are safety net clinics that 80% of their business is Oregon Health Plan,
mm-hmm.
and the other 20% is uncompensated, is uninsured at all. There are practices that have 40 or 50% Medicare or 60% Medicare or 30%. And so I think that generally the physicians, if you're in one of the safety net clinics, any change in reimbursement in Oregon Health Plan is extremely damaging if it goes down. If it goes up, they've got some room. But they're managing their payer mix based on the type of practice they are. Emergency room providers don't manage it at all. They take what comes. Largely the specialists as well. The pulmonologists are in the hospital, and 90% of the patients they see are Medicare.
So that turns out, I guess I need to get you to focus on this particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you have a mix of patients, the typical mix that comes to your office. A certain percentage of are Medicare, a certain percentage are Medicaid. They're spread across that panoply of 10 different plans that you have to work with. In general terms, you also have private folks that don't have insurance that come, private pay. Are the private pay folks paying more than the medical insurance reimbursements are?
First of all, I do not run a physician practice. I'm part of the health plan. But the physician charges exactly the same. Their fee schedule is exactly the same, regardless of who walks in the door.
Right, and granted, I understand that. I'm just one time
Medicaid,
to get to
Medicaid.
If the reimbursement rates are lower for all these managed plans,
mm-hmm.
and there's no advocacy group doing cost control on the private pay, doesn't the private pay person pay the full buck?
Yes. If in fact, some offices do have cash discount policies,
yeah.
and that is legal, and they do that. Those are individual policies within that physician office. But if they don't have a cash discount policy, they either write it off, they send them to collections, and try their best at collecting them, or they simply provide it as charity.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm there's nothing in my questions that's trying to impugn the reputation of the integrity of doctors. I think doctors, to a certain extent, end up probably providing more than the 10% in charity care that they were providing under the old Oregon Health Plan, but it may not be evident because of the cost shifting issues. You know, most of the physicians that I know certainly don't get all their costs reimbursed,
no.
and they are very reluctant to pass on the higher costs to private, non-insured. So I think they end up eating the difference.
They do. They, I would say largely they're, if the person has no insurance and no ability to pay, they're writing them off.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you a physician?
No.
Okay.
I'm a being counter guy.
You're being, okay, do you have like a PhD or something?
No.
I don't know if I call you a PhD or a doctor.
No, just see.
Okay. Okay. Dr. Crowe.
He is the
OMD me. A question and a comment first. It seems as though what you're saying is that so what we have is Marion Polk County is not perfect, but the health care, the health program as part of the mix is working, and it is providing services for most of the people in these counties who need the services. They're getting them,
yeah.
and it's working, and without a whole lot of shifting, some of it.
Well, there is cost shifting in here. If you're going to have separate differential fee schedules, you're going to have cost shifting. And I just wanted to speak to the cost shifting before Oregon Health Plan was far more significant than it was after Oregon Health Plan. And, you know, the access, if we're here to talk about access, what I want to get across to you is that this is a good model to deliver access, because we are managed and directed by the physician providing that access. And in fact, to be part of our organization, you have to be an Oregon Health, you have to take and be open to Oregon Health Plan patients. And that is not the case. Oregon Health Plan goes away, they can contract with Medicaid or not, and I can pretty much guarantee that the lion's share physician will not.
Thank you. You have another question?
Yes, I do. I wanted to pick up on the point that you made about access and just make sure that I fully understand what you're saying about the importance of what you are currently able to provide through the model. I believe I heard you say, correct me if need be, that everybody who needs access to a primary care physician can get that now.
Yes.
And when you say everybody, are you speaking of the 30,000 patients that you referenced who are served by the 450 doctors, or is there a population outside of that 30,000 that you're also referencing who also have that access?
Fortunately, in Marion and Polk County, we have a few providers that are open access pretty much to anybody, and that includes people without insurance, that includes people with insurance. Now, is every primary care physician open in Marion Polk County? Absolutely not. You've got to get on the phone and you have to call a lot of different places to find somebody. Also, beginning of the month is much better than towards the end of the month. But if you are in need of a primary care physician and you're on the Oregon Health Plan with Marion Polk Community Health Plan, we have agreements with several providers in our area with various geographic coverage that are safety net clinics, or they're clinics that are specifically designed for indigent and Oregon Health Plan and the vulnerable population, as well as some of the private providers that allow us to have an appointment and get you in the next day.
Mm-hmm. And then one last question, Mr. Chair. We have this document. Is this from your organization or?
No, I believe we left a couple of our newsletters over there.
Care Oregon.
That's Care Oregon.
Oh, this is Care Oregon.
Okay.
Okay. I appreciate the document. It's excellent, and I just wanted to draw the committee's attention, particularly to the section that starts on.
I'm sorry.
Page 12.
Page 12.
Right, which looks at disparities in healthcare, racial and ethnic disparities. You hear me talk about that issue a lot, not only in this committee, but in other committees. And this report does an excellent job of putting all of that in context. And these are issues that are important to all of our counties now, not just the Valley or Portland, et cetera. I was going to give you credit for giving us an excellent report, but it goes to another organization. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. And Dr. Palmer, you're next.
Good afternoon, Senator Minister and members of the Senate Subcommittee. Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting us here, and thank you for your patience.
Can you speak up? You're like me. You talk softly. So
thank you for your patience. And,
excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Unlike our chair, you speak softly.
Go ahead.
Sorry, for those of us who are hearing impaired, it's a problem. Both you and the chair.
I'm in that stage where I'm beginning to be hearing impaired, and I am. I'm going, a lot more. So, doctor, go ahead.
I'm Dr. David Balmer. I'm the medical director of Marion Polk Community Health Plan, and I'm also an assistant clinical professor
preventive medicine at WHSU. Before I took on the job of being a medical director of a parent health community health plan, I was the medical director of Mid-Valley IPA, which is the parent organization of the LLC, Marion Paul Community Health Plan. And for a year and a half, we managed four regions, the Oregon Health Plan population. And at the, in May of last year, regions decided that they were going to cut their losses. I think they were $12 million out of pocket for managing Oregon Health Plan, and they were going to cut their losses and drop Oregon Health Plan. And so Oregon Health Plan became available, as it were, and we were encouraged and invited to pick up and continue managing this population. And people said, you know, well, why would you want to, you know, pick up such a losing proposition? But for us, unlike Oregon, unlike Regents itself, and like some of its delegates, we were holding to the OMAP guidelines, and we were keeping our head above water by managing the population in that way. And so we had a board meeting, and we were invited by the governor at that time to pick up the pieces. And it wasn't just that the medical staff, the members of Mid-Valley IPA were being courted by the governor and decided to take it on. They thought that it would be the best thing for the community to pick up the program, recognizing that it's not all altruism, recognizing that to continue with the Oregon Health Plan, they were going to get better compensation from Oregon Health Plan than they would if all of these patients went open card. But when you think about access, there is a sort of a hidden dimension to access, and it isn't so much the number of patients that are looking for a number of physicians to cover their services. The hidden dimension of access is a willingness on the part of physicians to extend themselves to taking care of a population, and accepting that that the compensation that they're going to get for this population is going to be less than they're going to get for other plans that they're carrying, and that there is implicitly going to be some cost shifting for managing this population. But the board, representing the physicians of the community, decided that it was the right thing to do, and so they stepped up to the plate, and we took it on. And since that time, we have been administering the OMAP guidelines as tightly as we possibly can, and we have been able to stay barely within the budget which the Health Services Commission has designed. And I think that the reason that we've been as successful as we have in gaining access, as ready access, as Dean has alluded to this population, is because the regional model works. When you have a group of physicians with whom you have a relationship, as we did with Mid-Valley IPA, and they're committed to supporting the organization, when they got on board for the Oregon Health Plan, it was on the basis of that existing relationship that we had that they were willing to provide, if not pro bono care, at least care that was going to be financially less rewarding than the rest of their population. And that really is, it isn't because they didn't have anything else to do with their time that they took on this population, because in this particular community, there is a relative shortage of physicians, and these guys can fill their practices with paying patients, with well-insured patients, without having to take on Oregon Health Plan patients. So I think that it is the strength of a regional model of this kind that comes from the relationship which parent organizations have with their staff that supports support the ability for us to be able to continue to manage this population. I think that in a very sort of general, I spend my day trying to find the best way to spend the limited dollars that we're given in order to manage this population. And so I think about what I can buy for the money. And, you know, if something looks like it isn't a very good deal, I don't get it. If something looks like it's necessary and we can afford it out of the general budget, then we pay for it. I think that that kind of thinking spills over into considering what would happen if the Oregon Health Plan were to go away. And we would lose the federal match, and the population that we manage on a day-to-day basis is still going to stay here. If Oregon Health Plan goes away, the poor and the needy and the sick in the state are not going to leave the state just because there's no Oregon Health Plan. They're going to be here, and they're going to be needing care. And that care is going to have to be funded out of state dollars. It's going to be a poor conversion factor, and we are not going to be managing a plan which is going to be supported by our physician population. We are not going to be able to get access for that open card fee-for-service Medicare population without the Oregon Health Plan being in place. And that really, so those are the points I wanted to emphasize.
Frank? Doctor, thank you. Senator Farrelly has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, the question of a shortage of medical practitioners in the area has come up before. And I'm hearing from various medical associations that recruitment and retention in Oregon for new doctors is difficult. Could I get your opinion on why there's a shortage of physicians in an area like Marion Polk County? And is there a difficulty in recruiting and retaining physicians in Oregon?
There is. Managed care penetration is a great deal higher. Managed care penetration is a great deal higher in Oregon than it is in other states. And even in other Western states. It is, and the attraction, I think, of a large metropolitan area has to some extent mitigated that, that difficulty in Portland. If you look at the numbers of physicians per 100,000 of the population in Portland, it's about 25% higher than the number of physicians in Salem, and even worse in rural areas in Oregon. And so I think it's the attraction of the lights that probably have made the problem less severe in Portland, but nevertheless it is because of the lower reimbursement rate, because of the penetration of managed care in the state. The average remuneration for physicians in Oregon is 20 to 30 to 40% for specialists less than you would find in other states in the U.S. So physicians are poorly remunerated. There's a high incidence, there's a high prevalence of managed care in the state. And there's a gradient of attraction from the big cities down to the smaller villages.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the feedback I've had, is that low reimbursement rates and managed care bureaucracy tends to keep doctors out of Oregon. They can make choices to go to other Western states that don't have those similar types of problems. The other question I've got is, both of you have talked to the committee about what happens if the Oregon Health Plan goes away. Who told you the Oregon Health Plan was going away?
No, I just presume it's a big chunk of the budget.
think this guy's got a keen sense for the obvious.
Well, it's a big chunk of the budget, but I guess one of the things the committee, at least I've been hearing people in the committee saying that there's commitment here to maintaining the area health fund. I'd just like to know who's out there essentially raising the fear that what we're going to do is just take the plug on a plan.
I said that in the committee.
You said that?
I think I did. I think I said it, like Mr. Andretta. It is a budget option. It is a large chunk of the budget. It is in addition to Medicaid, and it is an option. Do you do the Oregon Health Plan or continue to fund the Oregon K-12 system at the rates that they're demanding?
Was that an example of somebody speaking softly and having a laugh?
Well, I got a stern lecture from Senator Gordon when I said it. I know that. I still remember.
Chairman, one more question.
Go ahead, Senator.
We have a relative shortage of physicians in this area, and we have a high penetration of managed health care.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're in bare balance, barely within the budgets designed by OMAP. Are we barely within the budgets because of the relative shortage of doctors in the area? And let me explain where I'm going with that question. You know, there's a joke. I don't know how funny it is in this instance, but we lose money on every single transaction, but we do a volume business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting the real sense that physicians and practitioners are in the situation in the managed healthcare environment with the low reimbursement rates of losing money on every transaction and then working harder and working longer and taking more patients and possibly increasing risk to themselves and their patients because of the volume of services that they have to deliver to stay solvent, which feeds directly back into tort liability and claims and legal liabilities and more costs. And every time you increase your patient volume by a few percentage points, I can't believe that the administrative volume doesn't also increase. So I'm asking you, if you had a higher density of doctors in the area and therefore spread the patient load among more, does that tip you over financially? Because like right now, you can always go work harder and work longer and balance your costs because you're doing a greater volume, even though you've got to be locked in a diminishing returns equation. But if there were sufficient physicians here and fewer patients, would that tip your budget over under this plan? Are we building toward a success that causes doctors to conclude Oregon's not a good place to practice?
It isn't of course just a problem for the Oregon Health Plan. It is true in every insurance plan, and that is that the employers can no longer afford the increases that we're seeing annually for commercial and for commercial insurance. The costs of pharmacy and technologies are going up faster and faster, and when that budget gets pinched, it's the primary care doctor who's going to be feeding it first because of their fixed costs.
Mm-hmm.
If there were more doctors who flooded the area to provide services, it seems I'm going to pass this question over. Dean, because this is something more like a financial answer than you want, than some speculations on the GC.
Well, I think you're right, particularly in the clinics that have reliance or that have their heavy clientele in the Oregon Health Plan or uninsured, that a volume change, they have to see a critical mass of patients in order to keep the doors open. And if there's a flood of physicians that takes patients away, they can't see as many, we have a problem. We're going to have to then increase the incremental cost of what we're actually paying them. And so I agree with that statement that, you know, where there's access, there's cost. They build it, you build it, they will come. And, you know, you alluded to the hospital buildings and things that are going on, and some we're going to pay for those costs one way or another, and so I agree that in partial you can bring your costs a little bit lower when there is a heavier volume in an eclipse.
Mr. Chairman, we, we're all aware that the Supreme Court has overturned a liability cap on tort.
You know the name of that case, by the way. Is it the Lakin case? Is that right?
Okay. And as a result, a lot of the OBGYNs in Oregon are no longer practicing. They're leaving the practice because they cannot afford the liability insurance coverage that adds $400 or $500 per case to their costs. Those that are still in practice, particularly those that practice in clinics and hospitals that serve uninsured, especially those that haven't had good prenatal or care during their pregnancy, are running a greater risk. We're concentrating the risk of liability into hospitals, emergency rooms particularly, or physicians that continue to take uninsured or uncared for or undoctored high-risk medical cases. And that's part of this equation. And we haven't even talked about that here, but that's a big part of the equation. And I guess I'm fascinated by the idea of the diminishing returns situation that doctors and clinics find themselves locked in. You got to do more. You got to work longer. You got to take more patients. You have to see more people. You have to put more people through the system at a lower reimbursement rate. You're working harder and seeing more people. The unintended consequences is harder to get doctors to come help with the work. They're going to earn less. They're going to be exposed more to liability questions because you're seeing more patients and less time. You're trying to build more access into your day to try to serve those people. And that means, you know, everybody's human. You're going to do a higher volume. You're going to have an error factor. And it may be increasing because of those pressures. So one of the most vulnerable populations under the current system are practitioners. And we overlook it. We just think that doctors are, I don't know, maybe they're like temples. If you break one, you can just go get another one. But I don't think that's necessarily true in a situation where we're relying on physicians to be part of the managed care continuum. But I'm concerned that they're sort of wrecking it up and going on, and there's a place and time when they will not do that because they don't have any more capacity to do that. It's not really about their willingness to do it. It's about their capacity to do it.
All right, any final comments? I think all of the dialogue's been pretty good. We could probably keep asking questions ad nauseum. And I'll almost want to grab Scott Gallant and drag him up and ask him some questions from LMA, but I don't know that I will. I'll probably defer them. But it does point, the whole discussion points to me that there is a need for the legislature to be a little bit more involved in some of this dialogue. There are some public policy questions involved. Is that, health plan continues to exist, does it continue to exist as it is, or are there financial controls or reimbursement rate schedules, capitation, you know, methodologies that need to be reviewed and changed or whatever. But there are some larger questions regarding nurse shortages. I mean, nurses play a significant role in delivery of health care, physician assistants and other paramedical, I don't know if that's the right term, practitioners. And a shortage is there. People that, we heard this last session that we had a shortage of nurses. I don't know what the capacity is within the institutions around the state to train nurses and how many people are tracking that direction. A lot of people go to law school, but not necessarily many wanting to become engineers or even physicians. I think to the extent that you do have a medical malpractice liability problem, someone might decide not to become a medical practitioner where they're actually seeing patients. They might want to become a forensic pathologist or something, or someone who's not necessarily exposed to the same kind of potential problems. So I appreciate your being here today and sharing with us. Feel free to communicate with members of the committee if you have additional ideas. And I don't think the committee is going to meet tomorrow. I think we're going to get some time, hopefully, to digest some of the material that we have in front of us. We've got a lot of stuff. And anyone out there who would like to talk to the committee, okay, come on up, James. Is Dr. Davis back? I saw him leave the room, but I wasn't sure if he came back. He did have to leave. Okay. When you see him, let's send our apologies to him. I didn't know that he had a time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, and asked staff to pass out some information that is some evidence of what happened in Maryland when they eliminated the Medicaid reimbursement for dentists to treat adults. And just put very simply, the dental visits to emergency departments of the hospital went up by Medicaid recipients by 21.8% in the study. And it says this occurred during the same period in which the percentage of all emergency department visits by Medicaid recipients was decreasing. So I just wanted to point out to you, someone on the committee had asked for some evidence about what the actual impact is if you start cutting Medicaid services. And I just want you know the ODA does support adult dental in the Oregon Health Plan. We'd like to see it continue to be funded. And certainly children, we understand that's not on the table. But here's some evidence.
All right, Jane. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Meyer?
Not for Ms. Meyer, Mr. Chair, but the folks from Care Oregon were told that they would have the opportunity to come back and share comments. So I would just like to ask them if there was anything more they wanted to put
sure,
on the record.
Sure, if they want to come back up and share some comments, they're welcome to do so. Ruby.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Hott, and I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for Care Oregon. I have with me Joy Soares, who is an access developer for Care Oregon, and I shared with you her background. She was taking you through quickly our providers, who would be doctors, nurses, specialists, et cetera, that care for our patients. And she was sharing with you information about who our clients are who are on the Oregon Health Plan. There's 90,000 individuals that are being served through Care Oregon and the Oregon Health Plan. Okay. Again, for the record, Joy Forrest, Care Oregon Access Developer. I think one of the important things that we want to share with you is to remind you that one of the reasons why Oregon Health Plan expanded was to be able to provide access to health care for the working poor. And the working poor are the folks that were added to the Oregon Health Plan. Before the Oregon Health Plan started, categorically eligible folks were the only ones that were receiving benefits, and those are the blind, disabled. And then it was added that anyone below the poverty line could access health care. And I wanted to share that with you. And that Care Oregon's been working with this population for 8 years. So we feel we're pretty experienced in working with not only our providers, but also our members and working with anyone that's below the poverty line and understanding their needs and how we can best assist them. Because what our goal is to be able to make sure that the chronically disabled or chronically ill, that their care is being managed in a way that will make it so their quality of life has increased, at the same time making sure that the possible expenses of not managing their care do not become a problem. And so that's why we have case managers working with our chronically ill members to making sure that they get access to the health care that they need in a timely manner, in a way that makes it so their conditions do not get worse. So they can either eventually get better, or we can just continue to make sure that the costs don't accelerate as much as they would have if no one had been case managing those clients. And of course, that also has the added benefit of keeping people out of the emergency room and increasing their health status. And so the folks that are working, we can keep them healthy enough so they can continue to work, and we can also manage the chronically ill. And again, with regards to our provider panel, we have over 2,000 providers that are contracted with Care Oregon. And they run from every gamut to the small rural provider who is a solo practitioner who has one employee to providers that are part of a larger system, for example, OHSU or Legacy, that provide care to many members, and of course, everything in between. And that goes for nursing facilities, hospitals, the whole gamut of any provider that provides care for our members. And wanted to share with you an example of a success that that helps with gets at the access issue. There was an organization, the Oregon Trail Independent Physicians Association in Umatilla County, that disbanded as of August 31st of this year. And that included approximately 25 physicians who were no longer contracted with Care Oregon because they were no longer contracted with their Independent Physician Association, the IPA. And so at that time, they had a choice of contracting with Care Oregon or not. And all of them, except for one, have chose to contract with Care Oregon. And they cite that the reasons why they did do that is because of the quality of services we provide to our members and the customer service that we provide them. Because even though they know that their reimbursement rates are low, they know that they can depend on us to help them, to help navigate patients through whatever systems that they need to go through so they can receive quality health care. And the one provider who did not choose to contract with Care Oregon did so based on rate, as many other physicians have chosen to do.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions, Ruby? Joy? Thank you very much, Ruby.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify before we begin? Okay, Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know it's late in the day, and I'll be brief, but some of the conversation in the last hour or so touched on some issues that we might be able to help bring some light to. For the record, I'm Tom Holt, Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our members are pharmacists practicing in retail, hospital, long-term care, mail order, any practice setting you like to name, we have them. Just in brief, access to pharmacy services in the Oregon Health Plan is now a very serious issue. The state's most recent cut in reimbursement to pharmacies took effect on September 1st at AWP minus 14%. And for those of you who don't know what AWP is, I won't bore you with it, but it's a reference price off of which it is published, and it's the only means we have to set contract rates for pharmacies. I can tell you that I don't know what the impact of that is yet. We're only 10 days into this. But Washington State went to that rate about a month ago, and already there are vast areas of Washington State where there is no pharmacy service. So it's a very serious problem. When people lose access to pharmacy services, they end up in emergency rooms and impose other costs on the system. Pharmacies, like emergency rooms, are an on-demand service. A pharmacy does not get to, as you heard from some other providers today, say, well, we've got this mix of Blue Cross, this mix of cash-paying patients, we've got this mix of Medicaid, and we'll take this many Medicaid. No, our folks are either in the plan all the way or they are not in. Now, if by virtue of your location, if you're out in your area of Center Prairie, where 40% of the population is in Medicaid in some form, then probably 40% or more of your patient load is going to be in the Oregon Health Plan. We also see in the pharmacy program, the fee-for-service side, the sickest elements of the population that the permanently disabled, mental health, and so on, that are not part of managed care, they also tend to require the most expensive medications. That's just a fact that we have to deal with. It's been our observation, there's been a lot of conversation before the committee in the last several days about general management of the program, that OMAP's entire solution to cost is cut provider rates. Not just us, but other providers, but certainly in our arena, we have offered time after time after time with the agency to come up with ways that make sense that would, A, deliver better outcomes for the patients in the Oregon Health Plan, and in the long run, save costs. A very practical example is medication management services for people who have high numbers of prescriptions. We know from studies that once you get up to a certain number, there's a very high probability that there is probably something that people don't need or that there are bad interactions for and things of that nature. There's just been no engagement from the agency on these kinds of ideas. Their simple solution is, well, we'll cut your rate and, oh, you'll make it up on volume. Well, we don't make it up on volume. And so there is cost shifting. You know, one reason we hear a lot about and why there's such a problem with seniors and their prescription drug costs is they are the last big group of cash-paying patients for pharmacies.
Say that again for me.
One of the biggest reasons that senior prescription drug costs have become an issue is that seniors are, by and large, the last significant group of the population that does not have coverage for prescription drugs. You know, somebody has to pay for low rates from state programs and from managed care. That's just what's occurred. And just last, an answer perhaps to your question, Senator Minnis, about the AWP spread for oncology. I can't speak to what there are physicians who do their own oncology drug service within their offices. So I can't speak exactly to the numbers that you were given. But what I can tell you is that there are different acquisition costs for different classes of trade in the drug distribution system. So a physician will have one price, a hospital another price, a retail pharmacy, typically the highest price of acquisition.
And those prices are set by?
Those are generally set by the manufacturer.
So an AWP is set by the manufacturer, but the cost which hospitals buy, that's set by the manufacturer?
Yeah. Okay. But in general terms, in oncology, there are larger spreads between the reimbursement rates and contracts and the acquisition costs because in that category of patient, you have a lot more specialized services required in association with the drug therapy. For example, it is very common for oncology patients to require special compounding, put the drug into a form that patient can actually use and succeed with that may not be the common manufactured form.
Do you happen to know what the acquisition price is for hospitals on medications?
Chairman, I have no way of knowing what any provider's exact acquisition rate is. I can't ask that question because of antitrust law.
There's not a standard.
No, there is not no
20% of
the standard acquisition cost for anyone. It's all negotiated in contracts from wholesale suppliers and the drug companies.
All right. Senator Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're on to something that's a real significant issue here. I think we have to make the assumption that national chains have greater purchasing power and greater negotiating ability to require pharmaceuticals than local or regional chains, and certainly greater ability to negotiate on price for pharmaceuticals than a owner, single outlet, locally based pharmacy. I mean, is there any argument with that that you'd make?
Chairman of Senator Ferrioli, the answer is yes and no.
Without trying to pit your members against each other, I'm just trying to get to the idea of economies of scale.
Yeah.
Please move to date.
Most independent pharmacy owners are part of buying groups that allow them to play on more or less the same level playing field as a major chain. Just for one example, group of independent pharmacies that's active in Oregon is the Good Neighbor Co-op. And nationally, they have around 4,000 members. That makes them about the same size as Rite Aid. so they can negotiate pretty much on the same playing field as Rite Aid can.
How do they know if they're getting the same price that Rite Aid's buying it for, though?
Well, they can't, Chairman, they can't unless they'd like to.
Well, there's a lot of assumptions.
It looks like because of antitrust.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mr. Chairman, the I have the impression that the some of the larger outlets use the pharmaceutical department as a loss leader, if you're familiar with that term. That is, they offer discounts in prescription drugs to bring people to the store. And I was wondering if you could comment, Mr. Bolt, about the ability of a small neighborhood pharmacy to use the pharmacological department as a loss leader.
Chairman Senator Fairley, thank you for the question. I know that is a perception that pharmacy departments are offered as loss leaders in large stores. That may well be the case in some particular instances, but as an industry-wide, I know it is not the case. I know they're, from what I am told by pharmacy management people, they're very close to that point. Does a small store have the ability to do that? Absolutely not. You know, and it's kind of interesting to us that if it's even talked about in our arena, you know, but would you want to go to a heart surgeon who's doing heart surgery as a loss leader? I wouldn't.
All right. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
I think,
Mr. Chairman, I got a lot more questions for Tom.
Oh.
I really want to, if I could just ask one more question. That'd be okay.
Actually, I thought it would be interesting to have a committee hearing on the topic of pharmaceutical medicine.
We need to. We need to bring pharmacists in here. I want to know why they're losing money. I want to know why they're withdrawing from the Oregon Health Plan. I want to know why their capitation rates are so low. I want to know why the there's been no active dialogue between the association and the Oregon Health Plan administrators on reasonable and fair and equitable access. I want to know about the capitation methodology. I know you don't know anything about the capitation methodology because we don't know anything about it. I think that would be an absolutely excellent multi-hour hearing. I hope you schedule it on a day we can bring pharmacists in and members of the Oregon Health Plan and members of DHSM all to speak together about the issue of medical reimbursements for pharmacy.
Right. And I don't know whether we want to bring the pharma in, the pharmaceutical manufacturers in and talk to them or not or hold that separately. But we do need to spend a little bit more time talking about this whole topic because I think it is a major component of healthcare in the future and obviously in the present.
Chairman, this would be happy to work with you to arrange that kind of a panel and be more prepared for it.
All right, Tom. Thank you very much. Final questions, comments, anyone else wishing to testify? If not, we are going to be adjourned.